Welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. I'm back from vacation and delighted to be with you again. Since I was last here, a number of things have happened regarding one of the ongoing topics I like to talk about on this program, the global climate crisis. Hurricane Arthur made landfall in North Carolina, not unusual, then continued up the East Coast, as hurricanes do, but went all the way up to Nova Scotia. Also, several tornadoes came roaring eastward off the plains and the prairies and touched down as far as Ohio, which historically sometimes happens. But these went all the way into, instead of the northwest quadrant of the state, into the northeast quadrant of the state, which means the winds off the plains are pushing up now all the way to the foothills of the Appalachian mountain chain, the Allegheny Mountains there, which is new. And as for the severe drought in the Southwest and California, well, the lakes and reservoirs are drying up very quickly. And last week, the state of California turned off the showers and flush toilets in many state parks, and they brought in porta-potties instead. The soil in the agricultural fields in the Central Valley and elsewhere is very, very dry because the water table and the level of surface moisture has dropped so much. And you may have seen those documentaries on TV recently about the rivers of water that now rush under the glaciers and the ice shelves in Greenland and Antarctica. So they're detaching those masses, huge masses of ice from the rock underneath. And it's pretty clear that the rise in sea level for all coastal towns and cities everywhere is going to be far more than a few feet. Well, about 3 weeks ago, a high-profile group of financiers and D.C. operatives, calling themselves the Risky Business Committee, issued a report. Got a lot of media attention. The report was entitled Risky Business, and it's aimed at the national business community as well as policymakers. Their Risky Business report, which you can find online, makes the case with many charts and other factual data that the global climate disruption going on has already begun to cost and will increasingly cost the business sector lots and lots of money. All gone. If you're a regular listener to this program, you know that when it comes to ecological sanity, my attitude is always, all late conversions are welcome. But sometimes that has to be said through gritted teeth because the situation is so maddening, and this is one of those times. Why? Because many of the authors of that report could be considered the blackguard group. I mean, they did appallingly disastrous things, made decisions that were so bad for the country, leading up to and during the big economic crash of 2008, to wit, Hank Paulson, the co-chair of the committee who wrote that report, if you recall, bullied Congress into giving all that bailout money to his home sector finance without any conditions, such as unfreezing credit nationwide and keeping the underwater mortgaged houses from flooding the market and worsening the crash. Another author of this Risky Business report was Bob Rubin. You remember he pushed through the horribly wrong financial policies of the last years of the Clinton administration. And another author is the former CEO and now chairman of Cargill. So in order to polish their blackened reputations, these folks decided to suddenly discover that we are, after all, living in a global climate crisis, which is going to hurt business. As Bob Rubin puts it on the Risky Business website, quote, I think we have to begin by recognizing the reality and severity of this threat to our economies, both United States and globally, and really to life on Earth more broadly as we know it, unquote. Yeah, right, Bob. But here's my question. What year is this? 2014? Why didn't Paulson and Rubin and Bloomberg and the others say all this in the mid-1990s from their pinnacles of influence when it could have done some good in time? That's when Europe got serious about cutting their carbon emissions following the scientists' reports of global climate disruption, but not us. Our leaders were into business as usual. At the same time the risky business report came out, Paulson, you may have seen, wrote an op-ed piece in which he called for a carbon tax. Wow, another original idea. Right, Hank, but what year is this? The environmental movement has been trying to get a carbon tax for 20 years. Where were you? Well, the last thing I want to mention in this these introductory comments is a review essay that Bill McKibben wrote a few weeks ago for the New York Review of Books. And it was on climate change books, of course, but it was mostly a big essay by him on the subject. And in it, he mentioned that the most that can be done now, this is someone who's really following the situation closely, most that can be done now regarding global climate disruption by drastically cutting carbon emissions is to slow down the rate of collapse and upheaval so societies can have a better chance of dealing with it. Wow, I read that and I thought, this is far different from a couple of years ago when he used to say, well, of course it's too late to stop global climate disruption, but we can lessen the amount of damage if we act quickly. But now it's just, the most we can do now is to try to slow it down. We earthlings are now at 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and that trajectory continues to rise. I would like to just make sure you know about a cover story that Bill McKibben wrote in the May 21st issue of Rolling Stone. It was entitled, A Call to Arms, An Invitation to Demand Action on Climate Change. And that article is mostly about getting people to come to New York City in late September for a huge grassroots demonstration near the United Nations that would be demanding greater action from world leaders. And they've been summoned there to a climate summit by Secretary General Ban Ki-moon to get the climate talks moving more seriously before the official continuation in Paris in December of next year. But here are some of Bill McKibben's observations, which are really interesting as usual. Quote, the world's leaders haven't been leaders on climate change, at least not leaders enough. Like many of us, they've attended to the easy stuff, but they haven't set the world on a fundamentally new course. Barack Obama is the perfect example. Sure, he's imposed new mileage standards for cars, but he also opened vast swaths of territory to oil drilling and coal mining, which will take us past Saudi Arabia and Russia as the world's biggest petro producer. Like other world leaders, that is, he's tried, but not nearly hard enough. Consider what he told The New Yorker in an interview earlier this year, quote, at the end of the day, we're part of a long-running story. We're just trying to get our paragraph right, unquote. And, quote, I think we're fortunate at the moment that we do not face a crisis of the scale and scope that Lincoln or FDR faced, unquote. So McKibben comes back and says, we do, though. We face a crisis as great as any president has ever encountered. Here's how his paragraph looks so far, McKibben says. Since he took office, summer sea ice in the Arctic has mostly disappeared. And at the South Pole, scientists in May made clear that the process of massive melt is now fully underway, with 10 feet of sea level rise in the offing. Scientists have discovered the depth of changes in ocean chemistry, that seawater is 30% more acidic than just four decades ago, and it's already causing trouble for creatures at the bottom of the marine food chain. America has weathered the hottest year in its history, 2012, which saw a drought so deep that the corn harvest largely failed. At the moment, one of the biggest states in Obama's union, California, is caught in a drought deeper than any time since Europeans arrived. Hell, a few blocks away south of the UN buildings, Hurricane Sandy turned the Lower East Side of New York into a branch of the East River. And that's just the United States. The world's scientists earlier this spring issued a 32-volume report explaining exactly how much worse it's going to get, which is, to summarize, a lot worse than even they'd thought before. It's not that the scientists are alarmists, it's that the science is alarming. Here's how one Princeton scientist summarized the situation for reporters, quote, "We're all sitting ducks," unquote. So McKibben ends by saying, "The gap between we're all sitting ducks and we do not face a crisis is the gap between half-hearted action and the all-out effort that might make a difference." Might make a difference. It's the gap between changing light bulbs and changing the system that's powering our destruction. It's very clear that the fossil fuel industry has five times as much carbon in its reserves as it would take to break the planet. On current trajectories, the industry will burn it, and governments will make only a small whimpering noise about changing the speed at which it happens. Unquote. Well, my guest today, although I'm not sure they're able to reach her in Ottawa, I hope, is to be Maud Barlow. So I'll introduce her and hope that they can reach her in the next moment.
I'm right here, Charlene.
Oh, you are on. Good.
I've been listening to your wonderful opening.
Well, thank you. The last message I got, didn't tell me you were on, but I'm awfully glad you are. So let me tell the listeners who you are. My guest today is one of the most well-informed, savvy analysts and activists on the crucial area within the dynamics of our ecosystems and climate crisis, that is water. Maud Barlow is the author of 16 books, including the Blue Trilogy on Global Water Issues. The first two volumes, which were international bestsellers, were Blue Gold, and the subtitle is The Fight to Stop the Corporate Threat of the World's Water, co-written with Tony Clark, and then Blue Covenant, subtitle, The Global Water Crisis and the Coming Battle for the Right to Water. The third volume, which we'll be hearing about today, was published just a few months ago. It's entitled Blue Future, and the subtitle is Protecting Water for People and the Planet Forever. Maud Barlow is the national chairperson of the Council of Canadians, Canada's largest public advocacy organization. She also chairs the board of Food and Water Watch, an organization based in Washington, D.C. She serves on the board of the International Forum on Globalization, based in San Francisco, and she's a counselor with the World Future Council, based in Hamburg. And I did a program on the World Future Council on July 12, 2012, by the way, if you'd like to find out more about it, and locate it in the PRN archives. Maud Barlow served as senior advisor on water to the 63rd president of the United Nations General Assembly and was a leader in the campaign to have water recognized as a human right by the United Nations. Last October, the Toronto Globe and Mail stated that she has one of the most thorough and comprehensive understandings of her subject of anyone alive. She's joining us today from Ottawa. Maud Barlow, welcome to the program.
Delighted to be here.
Okay, well, in the past couple of years, it just seems that water events have become the most noticeable expression of the global climate crisis. I mean, either too much water in the case of frequent and extraordinarily forceful typhoons, hurricanes, storms, or too little water in the many areas of the world that are in severe drought. So that, plus the fact that the oceans are becoming acidified, the rivers are dwindling and they're polluted, And then on top of that is the hair-raising push by the private sector for privatization of the public water supply in lots of communities. So I'd just like to start by hearing your overview of the situation today with regard to water issues.
Well, thank you very much, and it's just a delight to be here with you, Charlene, today. Maybe I'll connect what you started, that very powerful statement that you made as an opening statement on climate change with the water crisis, because people tend to think of them as two separate issues, and they're not.
Mm-hmm.
As you rightly point out, climate change means that we have more water in some places, including flooding and water we don't know what to do with, and drying in other places, and so that's one very clear connection. Another clear connection is that water is often the first face of climate crisis. You know, running out of water means you can't grow food, means you've got refugees, you might call them climate refugees, but often they're water refugees. So there's a connection there. But the connection I'd really like to make here is that climate change is not just created by greenhouse gas emissions. I'm not at all downplaying the enormous role that runaway greenhouse gas emissions play, and, you know, very much agree with everything you said. At the same time, we need to look at the way we are abusing, polluting, and most importantly, displacing water from where nature put it to where we want it, which means that we dry up watersheds, which means that that in turn warms up the local hydrologic cycle, the soils dry up, and so on. And we need to start asking ourselves the question, what role is our abuse of water and our displacement of water playing in the creation of climate crisis? So it's not just the impact on water of climate crisis, but it's the impact of water on climate crisis. We now know, for instance, that air that is passing over vegetated land carries twice as much or more water than air moving over non-vegetated land, land that's been cleared or pavement or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, if you cut down a rainforest, it's not just the forest that goes, the rain goes. And there's a recent study from Leeds University in England that shows that if the Amazon continues to be cut at the rate it's being cut now, they can actually predict the lack of rainfall, that it will fall something like 21% by 2040. Because you started off talking about the climate crisis, I just wanted to point this out, that we are a planet running out of clean water. We all learned back in grade 6 or whatever that that was impossible, that there was a finite amount of water, went around and around in the hydrologic cycle, and Bob's your uncle, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what we now know is that even that, though that water may be somewhere on the earth, we are polluting it, mismanaging it, and then we are using it to produce massive amounts of commodities for the global food market that then are shipped out, the water is shipped out of the watershed with the commodities, be it corn or cotton or rice or beef or whatever. If you grow it and ship it away, you're shipping the water that it took to produce it away as well. So we are in fact a planet. Even though it may seem that there's more water in some places, which may be temporarily true, we are, as a planet, as an overall reality, running out of accessible clean water. And we're running out at a particularly alarming rate. And so when we look at the whole question of climate plus water, it is my deep, deep belief that we have to put water into the equation, because just as destroying a watershed or an aquifer or draining a lake or a river creates heat and more climate change, restoration of watersheds is one of the most important antidotes to the global climate crisis.
Mm-hmm. Wow, all these observations you've opened with are things we don't like to think about in California.
California is the perfect example.
Yeah, messed up the natural system.
Absolutely. The engineering that has gone on there. Look, when I used to speak in California, I would always be more sort of nuanced. I'd say, well, I know the laws are complicated here and it would be very difficult to change them. Now I just say flat out, the laws that were designed around water and land and water rights were designed in another century for another time and another reality. They were designed to bring ranchers and business and farmers into the state. And mm-hmm. so they gave them prior access and permanent prior rights to the water. And this system is destroying the water of California. You have enough water in California. The problem, I don't mean you, I mean one, that the state of California has enough water if it were used properly. But we have to go back to the drawing boards. We have to state that California needs the law that Vermont has for its groundwater, which is that the groundwater is a public trust that needs to be seen as belonging to everyone, that no one can own it, has the right to appropriate it or sell it for profit. It must be seen in a totally different way. We have to put priority of use on these waters and say that water for life, for drinking water and daily life, water for ecosystem protection, water for local food production, these needs must come before the needs of the big corporate agribusinesses or others who are playing fast and furious with water. And it's the story of California is very much an example of what a colleague of mine calls modern water, that is the notion that water serves us and our development models and our mm-hmm. industrial models. Mm-hmm. You know, he quotes an advisor to President Hoover when they were building the Hoover Dam, who said that America will become great when she conquers her water. This notion of conquering nature, conquering mm-hmm. water, moving it to where we need it and want it, mm-hmm. seeing it as a resource for our profit. This is the fundamental root of the problem that we have, and California is one of the best examples of what not to do. It's kind of like that program, What Not to Wear. This is what not to do.
Well, that just sounds incredible, and I hope a lot of people in California are listening to that, because the way you talk about shifting the whole ground of the conversation, shifting the framework of how we would think about it in the way that Vermont's laws apparently have on this groundwater, would be the only way to bring a sane resolution to this problem that, for some reason, Governor Jerry Brown, who's usually fairly good on environmental things, can't seem to get off the fence about, and that is fracking. Because, you know, fracking causes three problems that are already crisis areas in California. It takes a huge amount of fresh water out of the hydrological system, and it sets off methane releases. We already have a lot of air pollution, and it causes earthquakes. We have a lot of earthquake faults. So, you know, we can't get fracking, a moratorium or outlawed in California, and I think we won't unless we would have that whole shift of how to even discuss the issue that you just outlined.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more, and it is strange that the governor will not look at the facts on fracking. I mean, the massive amount of pollution of groundwater sources by the chemicals that are used, the permanent loss of these water sources at a time when people can't grow their crops, when people are going to have cutbacks in terms of their daily water use, and that at a time when we had no snowpack melt this year. People in California are being asked to make a terrible sacrifice while it's business as usual for the fracking industry and others who have access to this water. It's almost as if people who are looking at issues of energy or food production or trade or whatever don't have anybody advising them on the impact on water and nature. It's like if there are any scientists left over here who are looking at water, nobody's listening to them. Another example is the biofuels. California gives huge subsidies for biofuels. Biofuels use huge amounts of water, 1,700 gallons of water for 1 gallon of biofuels. They don't. The water doesn't exist in California for this biofuel subsidy, but yet mm-hmm. the state continues to subsidize as if, you know, the water issue is divorced from all other policy. In my book, I call for what I call a new water ethic. I say that we have to start putting water at the very center of every single decision we make, mm-hmm. every policy, all our policy directives, whether it's trade or the economy or food production or energy. We have to ask, what is the impact on water? And if the impact on water is negative, we have to go back to the drawing boards. We cannot continue to assume that mm-hmm. we're going to have water forever. We grew up with this myth of abundance, and that is all it is. It's just a myth. We're going to add another, you know, how many billion people, 9 billion, 10 billion by the 2050. And as you know, it's not population per se, but it's lifestyle, you know, a more so-called lifestyle, sophisticated lifestyle, which demands more water, we have a finite small amount of water on the planet, and we are not taking care of it. We're pulling that groundwater around the world up so fast, it's doubling every 20 years, mm-hmm. that in many parts of the world, those aquifers are going dry. Nature cannot replenish it at all. There is hardly a major river in the world that reaches the ocean anymore. We've so dammed and diverted them for a global food production. Our energy production, most sources of our current energy, from fossil fuels to nuclear and so on, are a threat to water and use huge amounts of water, yet we do not ask the question. We act as if we have all we want forever and ever, and, oh, by the way, if we don't, there's a technology out there that's going to come along and fix things, and of course that's right. A false hope that we just have got to put away.
Yeah. But speaking of hope, I mean, you're the only person other than myself on this vacation. I was back in Ohio for a couple of reunions visiting family and friends, and I kept saying, you know, the water's drying up very quickly. It's happening very fast in the reservoirs and lakes. The level's dropping. And I said, they say there's enough water for 2 years, but that's if it doesn't evaporate faster than they think, or if there's no El Nino this winter. And, you know, I imagine about 20 million environmental refugees moving back east across the country.
That's right.
And no one's ever talked about this except you.
I know.
But what I want to say is, listening to what you've just said so far, is the first time I've really felt hope, because there's a lot of fear. There's certainly fear in the agricultural sector, not only the big agribusiness operations out in the Central Valley, but in the town where I live, at the very southern part of the Central Coast area, where the local farmers, you know, they use 50% of our water locally, and statewide, agriculture uses 75%. So, of course, they're all afraid that people are just going to say, shut down your business. People in the cities need the water. But
that's
instead,
right.
You know, you say if we'd reframe it and say we don't need to do this anymore, we shouldn't be doing that anymore, we have enough if we do this, this, and this, I mean, I feel a whole lot better. Now, we have to break.
I'll make you feel even better when we come back, Charlene.
But when we come back, I want to get into Blue Future and your four principles,
okay.
From which you derive various both activist campaigns that have worked and also policy recommendations that could get us to what you envision. So we'll pause now for the break. This is Charlene Spretnak on All Together Now, speaking with my guest, Maud Barlow, author of Blue Future.
Something to talk about, babe.
Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, Maud Barlow, author of Blue Future. Okay, well, let's get into your vision of what you call a water-secure and water-just world. And you propose solutions in Blue Future that are based on four principles. So the first one is, water is a human right. How about that one?
Well, that's my favorite in a way, because that was kind of my entree into this. I learned more about the environmental issues after, but I was deeply committed to the women's movement years ago and have long watched the issue in the Global South where women have to walk miles to get water. So
mm-hmm.
I was very involved in the fight to get water recognized as a human right at the UN, which happened 4 years ago, almost to this day, in about a week. The United Nations General Assembly adopted and recognized the human right to water and sanitation. And it was a very important recognition. It took us 2 decades to get this recognition. Not all the countries agreed. My country did not. The United States didn't vote for it that day, but it did agree to the interpretation of it at the Human Rights Council 2 months later. So that was a good breakthrough for all of us. And basically what it says is that all governments have a responsibility to ensure safe, clean drinking water and sanitation to their citizens. If they don't have the financial wherewithal right now, that aid money, you know, we should try to collect that, and it should be directed to the most vulnerable. But every government has a responsibility to at least set up a plan. And I'll give you a good practical example of this in motion, and that is that you probably know the city of Detroit has been declared bankrupt, and the bankruptcy manager is wanting to sell off the water and sewage system, so they're wanting to get rid of the debt, and they're sent, they're turning the water off to over 3,000 residences a week, which means way more than 3,000 people, because most households have more than just one person,
right.
With the intention of maybe going as high as 120,000 by the end of the summer. And we're talking about a situation
where...
Wait,
when you say they're turning it off, they have already put it in the hands of private, or who's turning it off?
Well, they want to sell the water and sewage department, and they want to get rid of the debt. So who they've hired a private company that comes then and who hires men to come in and turn the water off. So they come in with no warning. First thing in the morning, you wake up to somebody banging on your door. They come in and they turn your water off. And for as little as not having paid your bill for 2 months. Some residents there have been getting bills of $7,000, $8,000, $9,000 because they're being billed for payments that were owed by the tenants who lived before them, or perhaps a leaking water main in the next tenement. It has not been run well.
They're turning it off to get people to pay back bills, whether they're just or not.
That's exactly right. That's right.
Okay.
And what is, it's important to remember that almost a million people have left Detroit, so they don't have the tax base there,
right.
And they didn't have the rate, so they didn't have the people for the rate, so they jacked up the price of water about 120%, and then 2 weeks ago about another 9%. And you're talking about some of the poorest people in the United States. They simply do not have the water. In some cases, their sewage and water bills are 20% of their income, and that's just about double the average in the United States, and just way too much for many, many families.
Yeah.
Several years ago, they came up with an affordability plan with the department and with the city council, which was, yes, understanding people have to pay for this service, but that no one who couldn't pay should be turned off. And they came up with an agreement and a process that was agreed by all sides. But once the emergency was declared and the state of bankruptcy, this is no longer recognized. They're just ruthlessly turning the water off. So I said to, I was there about 6 weeks ago, and we met as a bunch of groups to think about what to do, because there was no major media taking place on this in the U.S. So what we did is we launched a formal complaint to the United Nations Human Rights Council, to the Special Rapporteur on Water and Sanitation. She was so upset or concerned about what we sent in that she and the Housing Rapporteur and the Food Rapporteur put out a statement saying that they're going to do more investigation, but at first blush it sure looks like the United States is in violation of the human right to water and sanitation.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're directly appealing to President Obama, saying you cannot in the heat of summer allow this to take place.
Mm-hmm.
You have to declare a state of emergency, and the United States is in violation of the international law on the human right to water and sanitation. So there's a real practicality to this thing. We're able to actually point to it and say this is international law. Now, there's no army that's going to come in from the United Nations. Even Tea Partiers might threaten, oh my goodness, the UN's coming, but that's in fact, of course, not true, and they're not capable in any case.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a moral code that we have all agreed on, and for any major country to be breaking that moral code when you know, you think of it, aid money from the U.S. goes to just such projects in poor countries. I think it's a real wake-up call. And I also think it's a statement about our priorities and how we have had three decades of economic and social policies that favor the 1% and have allowed the situation in Detroit to deteriorate. And I don't think it's the last city, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the human right to water.
We've had policies for the 1%, and part of that, of course, is the whole privatization push since the Reagan administration. Just the ideology that, of course, it saves taxpayer money to contract all this out to private people to run what used to be the government agencies. But
it's
such a failure now. It's such a failure. If you have to put a profit motive in there, of course, they're going to start cheap, and they're going to raise the prices, and they're going to squeeze the workers, which erodes people who'd made their way up into the middle-class office jobs. And it's just a failure in every area where they've tried privatization, but still it goes on.
Well, anyway, you're absolutely right. And in fact, Food and Water Watch did a very good study of water systems in the U.S. that had been privatized and ones that had not. And it's very clear that aside from the lowered services, and that asked the folks in Atlanta, they kicked out the private company just 3 years into a 20-year contract. The water was coming out brown out of the taps. Mm-hmm. But the prices go up way more for a private facility because they're a for-profit company. They're not, they're not either bad or good. I say they're not moral or immoral. They're amoral. They're not allowed to be moral. Their job is to make money and be competitive.
Yeah, that's their internal logic.
It's all they're able to focus on because in the system that we have, the competition, if you start caring about the environment or people or whatever, sorry, you're going to lose in that market, in that fierce race to the bottom. So that's these essential services have to be paid for by governments. But here's the good news. And by the way, we're now getting into principle two, which is that water is a public trust, it's a common heritage.
Yeah.
I argue that it's not like running shoes or cars. Water, because it's a necessity of life, must be considered something that belongs to all of us in perpetuity. It must be used for the common good. We cannot allow the private sector or private interest to expropriate it for their own gain. But there's good news here, because you wanted some good news, and that is that the privatization projects are failing, openly failing, and municipalities all around the world are going back to public systems. In France alone, 40 cities, including Paris, the great big Paris, have remunicipalized their water systems. They went private.
Huh.
They were unhappy. They've gone back, and Paris has just announced that they've been able to drop their water rates quite considerably because, again, you take that profit motive out, and that money that people are paying for water service goes to better services or goes back in their pockets.
Right.
So we have been quite successful there. There are, however, other areas where water privatization is happening. It's not always these services. One is the whole notion of water trading, which is where a license is converted to a property, a kind of property, and private owners are able to buy and sell water on the open market. T. Boone Pickens in Texas is buying up huge amounts of the Ogallala Aquifer and selling it privately to developers. I believe he should not be allowed to do this, right?
Yeah, really.
And that's part of your situation in California, where private owners of water can actually sell it and then tap into the public tap. So that's where I go back to saying if the law in California and Texas and other places where this is being allowed were to say, no, it's a public trust and no one can appropriate it and it will never go on the open market for sale like running shoes or more appropriately as a comparison like oil and gas, because that's what people want to do. We will not allow that to happen. There is a finite amount of water. We have to take care of it, and we have to make sure that it's equitably and justly shared. This is the heart of the statement when we say public trust. And we have good public trust lawyers in the United States, like Jim Olson from Michigan, who are leading the way in teaching about how public trust is already in the law in many parts of the U.S., but not known, and people don't turn to it. They don't tend to use it. We don't use it enough legally in our legal cases, but it is there as a principle and one that we must expand and understand better.
Uh-huh. Okay, we have about 10 minutes left. Just to review, principle one was water is a human right. Principle two, water is a common heritage and a public trust. So what's principle three?
Well, principle three is that water has rights too. So when we talk about the right to water, that's the human right to water, I argue that we also have to talk about the rights of water, and that water and watersheds do not just exist for human consumption and human service. They have rights beyond their usefulness to us. Ecosystems, you know, have a right, you could argue, to exist, to thrive, to survive.
Mm-hmm. With their integrity intact.
Absolutely. Other species have a right to this water. It doesn't just belong to us.
Mm-hmm.
Future generations have right to this water. It doesn't just belong to us. So this notion is part of a growing movement called the Rights of Nature. I'm on a global alliance on the rights of nature, and it's a very exciting movement that basically says that too much nature, and in this case water, is seen as private personal property, as opposed to the living essential element of a living ecosystem that gives us all life. And that if we could turn our heads around and say, oh my gosh, goodness, the most important thing I can do is care for that water, is restore that water, is to protect that water in watershed governance, and that to think about governing not on political boundaries but on watershed boundaries, and to recast our human laws so that they take more, they're more, you know, they're more compatible with the laws of nature. See, I am hopeful. I really feel that if we could turn our heads around, that we, Gerard Manley Hopkins, the great Victorian poet, said there's a great dearness down in nature. It deep down in nature is there if we just stop abusing it. And that's the secret, is that we have to stop thinking of ourselves as masters of the universe. And I know that's heresy in some places, but it's necessary for us to grow some humility. We need a little humility limb or something to add it to our
again, you know,
arms, legs, and a humility limb.
I think the heart of the green broadly defined movement over 40 years was just to try to see that we're part of this dynamic, complex, and, you know, amazing totality. We're not the rulers of it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, you know, you mentioned bringing our governance in sync with the watersheds, and I don't know if you know, but back when the in the FDR administrations, when the federal districts were being set up, the TVA and all, there was an argument made to draw them according to the watershed boundaries.
That's exactly right.
Which would have been very interesting. It didn't go through, but we got kind of close at one point.
But you should know that Europe has brought in a European-wide law in 2000 that basically all the waters have to be governed on a watershed basis, regardless of which geographical boundaries they pass.
Uh-huh.
Now, it's not always as successful as everyone wants, but there have been some real successes. So it's not as if this is a crazy dream. This is an actual reality.
Well, New Zealand, I heard, reorganized their state or province lines according to watersheds a few years ago.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's move on to Principle 4.
Principle 4 is that water can teach us how to live together. And this principle basically says, look, we have a situation where the demand for fresh water in our world is going straight up and the supply is going straight down. A global study that was done just a couple of years ago said that the demand for water by 2040 by 2030 will outstrip supply by 40%, which is just an astoundingly frightening statistic. Okay, when you think of the human and other suffering that will take place.
Yeah.
So the question is then, in a world where demand is going up and supply is going down, will water be a source of conflict, of violence, and potentially war? And I could say already, I bet I can say you the yes. I mean, in Syria right now, water is being turned off and denied to the rebels. Water is one of the issues at the heart of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, and war right now. It was at the heart of the Egyptian uprising because they privatized the water and people couldn't afford the water rates and so on. This is already a weapon of war around the world.
Uh-huh.
But I argue that equally it's possible that water could become nature's gift to us to teach us how to live better with one another. That if we looked at each other and said, okay, my grandpa was taught to hate your grandpa, my dad was taught to hate your dad, and I'm supposed to hate you, but we both live on this river, and this river is in crisis. If we could just stop hating each other for a while and come together to try to save the river, because we don't have a future here, either of us, or our families or our communities, if we don't save this water. And it's the whole notion of nature and water as peacekeeping and peacemaking, and it's a whole actual science or building around the whole notion of environmental peacemaking. And I'm wanting to be hopeful. I've got lots of examples of where communities are coming together and putting aside ancient grievances to, you know, to say, look, we've got a comet coming. It's like those Hollywood movies. We've got a comet coming at us. But instead of being able to send, you know, I don't know, some movie star up to blow it up, the comet up, we have to come together. And maybe we'll learn some humility in the bargain. Maybe we'll learn to live more lightly on the earth. Certainly we can learn to live better with one another. And that's, I see water as a great source of hope, because I think water is very beautiful. And I've seen it bring people together in amazing ways.
Wow. I have to say, even though I think I'm pretty well informed, this environmental peacemaking idea you just mentioned is really great news. Can you give us some examples of that? Where it has
yes, one is from the Middle East, and it's a group called the Friends of the Middle East. And they're people from the warring communities of Israel, Palestine, Syria, Lebanon, who came together to save the Jordan River. And they don't talk politics, and they don't talk, you know, religion or whatever. They come together, and they've been so successful that there's a small area where a piece of the wall has been taken down, because the kids all got to know each other and realize they're just kids, right? Each other is just like themselves. And recently they were successful in getting water restored to the Jordan River, and they did some community cleanup and so on together. Now, I'm sure that the current situation has set that back. You know, I'm not Pollyanna-ish about what we're dealing with here. But, you know, it's the old story of the animals around a watering hole. If there's lots of water, they're fine. If there's not a lot of water, they start eyeing each other. You know, so we need to care for this water, these limited sources of water. Another good example is a treaty that was done between Mexico and the United States on the major rivers, a couple of major river sources between your countries. We tend to, when we have, and I have several examples in the book on these major river treaties. You tend to come at it saying, okay, what can I get out of this? I'm only here to represent my country's interests, so I want X amount of water, and this country wants X amount of water, and we're going to just fight over it, and we'll come up with an agreement, and then I'll take that water whether I need it or not. But there are examples where the two countries have said, well, I don't need as much water all the time. When I need it is situational, if there's a drought. So can we have an agreement that if, and then one of the treaties here, the agreement was that there would be reparations paid to Mexico for damage that was done by a hurricane in exchange for allowing the water to stay north in times that Mexico didn't need it. In other words, you're looking at the flux and, you know, the flow, the ebb and flow of the water system itself, and not dividing it up as if it's a bathtub, but rather seeing it as an ecological system and seeing what's the best use of that land and that water, the land along the water and the water itself, and how can we protect the water and all of us have a fair share. So it's not us versus you, it's us together protecting the water for all of us. And it's just a different way of looking at negotiating than traditionally negotiators tend to do. They tend to go in just looking after the interests of their own country. And if you look after the interests of the watershed, you come up with different types of agreements.
And I've noticed there are watershed councils that are part of county governance, or at least in California. I think a lot of other states.
Absolutely. And they're not often enough listened to, and often enough they won't have authority. They'll set guidelines, they give advice, but often they're not listened to, and they get very frustrated because, you know, the authorities know best kind of thing. And then, of course, you get the big corporate interests wherever any of this happens. You mentioned fracking, and there are so many of them, so that a community may know what's best for it, but that doesn't mean that the community's heard. So I think it's really important to empower these community citizens commissions and watchdog projects like this in law to protect them and give them some authority. That's what they've done in Europe. Watersheds are governed by citizen groups that have elected officials on them, but the citizens also have authority. And so they have authority of their own outside of the political boundaries of the countries involved. And so you have to give up some sovereignty. People say, well, you know, the U.S. would never do that. And I say, well, countries give up sovereignty when they sign trade agreements.
That's
they give
right.
up lots of sovereignty. They give up sovereignty to transnational corporations.
That's right.
I would much rather give up sovereignty to protect a watershed than give
right.
up sovereignty for, you know, Monsanto or whatever. So it's a case
you're right. I think it is going to force a rethinking of what's the meaning of national sovereignty if you're committing ecocide. You know,
it's
you have
exactly
to find a new
right.
way to think about this.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Very exciting.
Well,
and it means you really are looking at governance in a new way, and that's one of the things that we call
right.
for, is that watershed governance needs to be come at it a very, very different way.
Yeah. Well, this has been so inspiring. That's all the time we have. But Maud Barlow, I want to thank you so much for coming on the program.
It was my entire pleasure. I loved it.
Okay. Oh, well, let's move over to the Arts Corner. We have some Canadian features here this week and also about water. Actually, the song we're coming to will be Canadian. But we'll start with our poem, and this week it is about water. It's called At Blackwater Pond by Mary Oliver. And this is in Volume 1 of her collected poems. At Blackwater Pond, the tossed waters have settled after a night of rain. I dip my cupped hands. I drink a long time. It tastes like stone, leaves, fire. It falls cold into my body, waking the bones. I hear them deep inside me, whispering, oh, what is that beautiful thing that just happened? For our song this week, we have one that's sung by two Canadians in honor of our guest today, Maud Barlow, and this song is about water. It's Kate and Anne McGarrigle singing the swimming song. Here it is.
My feet and I move my arms around, move my arms around. This summer I swam in the ocean and swam in a swimming pool. Salt my wounds, chlorine my eyes. I'm a self-destructive fool, self-destructive fool. Not all. I did the breaststroke and the butterfly and the old Australian crawl, the old Australian crawl. This summer I swam in a public place at a reservoir to boo. At the latter I was informal, at the former I wore my suit, I wore my swimming suit. Swan dives and jackknives for you all. And once when you weren't looking, I did a cannonball, did a cannonball. This summer I went swimming, this summer I might have drowned. But I held my breath and I kicked my feet and I moved my arms around, moved my arms around.
That was Kate and Anne McGarrigle singing the swimming song. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give 'Em Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. If you'd like to see who my guests will be for the next few weeks, go to my website, charlenespretnak.com, and click on the tab that says Radio. Next week, my co-host, Eleanor LeCain, will be here with her guest. I'll be back 2 weeks from today on July 31st with my guest, Reverend Sally Bingham, founder of Interfaith Power and Light, the national network of congregations working on the climate crisis. Thanks for joining us. This is Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now. Now that you know.